Welcome back to Grit. In this episode, we talk to media lawyer Steve Kunchevich and deep dive into the legal arenas that face creators, particularly copyright, distribution, and areas that often affect creatives in the business side of the creative industries. Great, so we're going to jump over to Manchester now to speak to Steve Kunchevich. Hi, Steve, how are you?
I'm good, John, how are you?
Good. It's been too long since we last caught up, and I feel that we converse all the time online about films and TV and so forth, but it's really nice to catch up in person. Steve, for the context of the audience, and I'm wary that we're now going into the area of like expanding into the creative industries. I've talked to a lot of DOPs and editors and so forth, and people forget there's this whole, all these other layers within the creative industries. And when you say lawyer, people always think that's the person you go to when there's a problem, but you and I know that's not the case. So Steve, you are a media lawyer, and do you want to explain what that term means and the kind of areas of media that you cover, and just a little bit of overview?
Yeah, I'd love to. And for any of John's students or anyone else that's listening, by far one of my highest value Facebook friends with some of the best opinions. Yeah, so what do lawyers do? Let me commoditize my day down as far as I can. It's a weird all-encompassing thing. On a really good day, I'll get asked to look at a load of campaign work for some of my public relations or some of my marketing clients, usually with the question attached to it, am I going to get sued? That's funnier than others. When I've been working from home, my son's been sat next to me and some creative will come in and it's on a property he likes, and I'll say, what do you think of that? Is that too similar to this? And I'll kind of take his steer. So, but it's interesting, you know, it depends what you're doing. Campaign material, campaign advice is normally pretty easy. When you get into production, different thing altogether, because we, you know, if you're certainly thinking about location filming, there's lots of really good guidance out there, say from Film London, there's a really good guide from them as to everything you need to think about, you know, when you're shooting buildings, what you kind of can't do with brands, health and safety on set, all that kind of stuff. On a really good day, I get to enable creativity.
Right.
In a load of ways I didn't see. On a bad day, sometimes I need to tell someone something's a terrible idea. But hopefully those days are few and far between.
Right. And do you think, like, I think particularly now there are so many levels to, like, particularly the thing that people worry about is IP or intellectual property. And I think it's the hardest thing for creatives to get their head around. But it's also one of the biggest areas of their actual revenue streams, ultimately, well. So it's, and I think there are so many different channels now. When I started out, I just had to worry about like broadcasting and film distribution and that, and maybe VHS and so forth. But you didn't have to worry about that. Is that getting much more complicated for, like, particularly producers?
I think it's a different landscape now. Certainly. I think the landscape changed when David Fincher took House of Cards to Netflix and streaming became a force. And now you've got all these other avenues and routes to market for creatives that you didn't have before. Some of them way more lucrative and way more immediate and way easier to get your story out there and your concepts out there than ever before. But it's tough. I mean, I suppose where it gets interesting is you'll set out wanting to make something, and then years ago, you might have had an idea of where you thought it would go. This is going to be, you know, if it's a film, it's going to be released, and there's going to be the home video, there's going to be special features and things that go with it. Now it can take on a life that you had no idea it had. And planning for the future in an era where tech is moving so quickly and certainly advancing ahead of the law in particular, and we consume media in different ways, you know, the TikTok generation, for example, the issues that gives rise to about the use of music that YouTube had to cope with, say, 15 years ago. It like, as Ferris Bueller said, you know, life moves fast, and unless you look around once in a while, you might miss it.
Yeah. And I think that it's also, as a creator, you're putting stuff out there, and there's a lot of opportunity for exploitation or rights infringement. And I think a lot of people really can't get their heads around what rights they give to stuff. And particularly when I'm dealing with younger creators who are starting to maybe dabble in doing professional social media posting and so forth, they really struggle to know, like, well, what am I getting paid for? And the levels, is that, do you find that a lot with, like, particularly the social media side?
The social media side of it's really interesting because, you know, from working with an awful lot of influencers and content creators, they see, I think, depending upon the what they're doing, if they're doing a tie-up with a brand, for example, I think sometimes they might see that content as inherently more disposable because it's tied to a particular message, it's tied to a particular, you know, product or service, as opposed to if they're just setting out to create something for the love of creating it. And that ties into the fact that normally when we're working with brands and influencers, the brand will want to own everything. And the creator will sign an agreement to sign that away. Increasingly, what we say to people is, say to creators when we work with them is, do you really need to give that away? You know, do they need to own this and control it forever? Could you look to do some kind of other deal with it? Could you license it out? And that's the same with a number of agency clients that we work with. Do you want to be a vessel for somebody else's creativity, somebody else's ideas? Or do you want to come up with something of your own that you might think will find an audience and then that could be something that you've got control over and the ability to exploit until the end of the copyright or other IP rights in it? It's a real shift. And I think when our attention span gets shorter, and I think sometimes that comes with a risk of undervaluing the potential importance of content when you're looking at the likes of TikTok, where you've got creativity finding itself there in ways that you never could have envisaged about 10 years ago.
No. And you, I can remember you and I being very utopian when kind of like the start of Web 2.0. And that's how old we are, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I think like we were probably... I sometimes reflect on like 2012 Twitter. What a wonderful world it was. And you couldn't quite imagine where things went. And obviously now we're kind of going into allegedly a new sphere of the web 3.0, whatever that is.
Yeah.
And this whole idea of sort of decentralized web, NFTs, blockchain. Do you think that is going to be on the sort of plus side for creators or
NFTs are fascinating.
Yeah.
When you've seen Kings of Leon, I think, you know, and as I think about that, you know, you see Kings of Leon launching their album as an NFT, and an awful lot of musicians jumping on the back of it and, you know, sort of offering limited edition like NFTs with certain content and so on. That's going to get regulated, I think, sooner rather than later, because there's a real concern. You know, you can see the use case for NFTs in the art world, but I think there's a real concern that it could be an area for fraud. You know, how do you prove that you own something? Now, the answer to that, ideally, is that the blockchain sits behind all of that, so you've got a distributed ledger, and that could be really great for rights management. You know, if you're a musician and you stick something into a blockchain, you can see exactly how and where it's been used and by whom. You've got that immutable record of it. And for them, sometimes that's easier than having to deal with, say, collecting societies like PRS, PPL, MCPS, because you've got control over the raw information. NFTs, at the minute, feel a bit gimmicky to me, but they've got a huge amount of potential. But, you know, like anything else, there's going to need to be some kind of regulation for it, I think, before the wider market takes it as seriously maybe as it deserves to.
Yeah, because I think I got very excited with blockchain when it was sort of first being muted around, and I got particularly the idea of smart contracts.
Yeah.
And I suppose the reason was I had worked behind the scenes having to track down compliance and copyright and get things, you know, I had to once... track down Gary Cooper's estate to get the rights to 30 seconds of High Noon because it turned out to be an independent film, not a studio production.
Oh, wow, really?
So I had to go through his estate to get it cleared. And it was such a pain it's not that you don't want to pay people. It's almost like it was such a pain to track it down. And the processes were really archaic. And I just wondered, and it felt really annoying for the last sort of few years of like, why isn't this sorted, because then copyright is a bit easier.
Well, no, yeah, that's totally right. I mean, the other side of that argument is that copyright is the creator's friend because it's an unregistered right, so you can't go, unless you're in the States, to a site and look something up and see who owns it and see who you've got to ask permission for. You know, you can be walking around with a great idea for something, you fixate it in a permanent form, and copyright subsists as long as it's original. That doesn't mean that somebody else out there can't have the same idea as you and record it in a permanent form at the same time, and you come up with the same thing kind of simultaneously. That's the way a lot of the old music cases went for years and years.
Yeah.
And years. But as I say, but the upside, the downside to that is that you've got to have your chain of title. You've got to be able to show that it's yours. And because it's an unregistered right, there's kind of a, you've got to do a little bit of detective work. I've had to do that this week with Dr. Seuss. So
right.
One of my clients wants to do a parody of The Grinch.
Right.
Now you go to that and say, all right, so I'm going to start with the book. Surely that's, you know, that's the first place the Grinch as a character is. Random House's website, great. Terms of use on the website say everything on here belongs to Random House. Think, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, but hold on. What we want to do involves a certain representation of the Grinch that isn't in the book. It's from the movie. And the movie's 2000 and it's a Universal movie. You think, right, okay, well, maybe it's Universal. And then you dig back into it and you think, well, hold on, we want to call this something along the lines of the Grinch. Who owns the trademark? And then you find out that actually it's Dr. Seuss, the Dr. Seuss Foundation or something, Dr. Seuss Enterprises, I think. And his family, and as it is over there, his family controls a lot of that IP. So to be able to say to this client, okay, you want to do this, this is who you ask, I absolutely share your pain. Because it's a different thing if you're looking at one of the, you know, the preeminent IP, say Marvel, Disney.
Yeah.
You know, because Disney till all are one, you know, Disney own half of your mortal soul these days. But if you're getting into some of the more, the fringe, more interesting stuff, you know, if you're doing a movie and you want to include a clip, well, who do you go to? How much do you want? How much control do you want them to have over how you use that as well? Because, you know, if the creator has an idea about how they want that work presented, then you're stuck with that. If you ask for permission and you do it the right way, it's not only going to cost you, but it's going to come with it. It's going to come with limitations as well. So it's tough. I mean, the other side of that is if you come up with something and it's great, there's very little stopping you now from exploiting it on a world stage, because you've got that, you know, it's not just TV producers, it's not just broadcast, it's not just motion pictures anymore that can get your stuff out there. But policing that, and I think understanding your own power, but also that if your work involves work that is created by other people, there are very limited ways in which you can use that without having to ask for permission. It's a fair use, a very different thing in the US than it is in the UK. It's much, much, much more limited concepts over here. So it's, I'm not saying everybody needs to be an IP lawyer, but, you know, intangible assets and IP has never been worth more than it is right now.
No, and I think, I mean, like you raise a good point there, like that there are different jurisdictional elements to copyright law, but there is also a solid kind of international foundation as well, where the principles are all the same.
There's the Berne Convention, and the point of that is that, you know, you can be in a different state, but then you'll be treated, so say if you're a US copyright rights holder and you've got an issue in the UK, you're almost treated as a UK citizen. You're given equivalent protection around the world, and that can be incredibly valuable. And it was the one of the most interesting cases about that a few years ago was when George Lucas sued a guy called Mr. Ainsworth over making Stormtrooper cosplay outfits.
Right.
One of the most interesting cross-jurisdictional copyright cases, stay with me, that you'll ever see. But it is really complex. But around the world, creativity is respected and protected, maybe more often than people might think.
And also, it's kind of like, I think particularly when I start introducing these concepts and talking to students, it's kind of, you on one hand you can see creatives are like, oh, why do I have to deal with this business side? I want to just do pure creativity. And on the other side, I have seen increasingly with each generation that's come through, they're like, so how do I hustle this, how do I make money? Then they do want to know the business side more. Have you seen a shift in clients' perspectives, and like when they come to you, like, and how they involve you and how the client relationship management happens now? Has that shifted?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, nobody is ever going to get out a violin for lawyers, nor should they. The relationship tends to be transactional. You know, few people come to a lawyer when they're happy. It's a little bit of a different thing if you're working in, say, you know, film production, TV, whatever else, because you're baked in. You know, I spent a good amount of my time about 10 years ago vetting scripts and looking at TV broadcast deals around the world and dealing with different rights for distributors. And that just goes to show you how many ways you can potentially cut a piece of content and get something out of it. And think about something like Come Dine With Me, you know, is a really simple concept, but now a massively valuable international franchise from people just getting together and having, maybe not as much as it was, but people just having dinner with each other. I think there's, you know, there is much more of a sense of hustle culture. But equally, if you walk into it just with a commercial imperative, then I think sometimes that limits your vision. And
right.
I keep thinking about something like Alien, you know, because I'm a massive Ridley Scott fan, as we both
yeah,
are.
Yeah.
And that's an exercise in compromise. That's a studio saying, well, Star Wars has been out. We need a film about space. Okay, I'm going to give you this body horror film, and I'm going to give you this from the ashes of Jodorowsky's and Ridley Scott's attempt to make Dune. And it's all bits and pieces of leftovers, but we're just going to make it, and we're going to put it out in the world, and it takes on a life of its own. I think maybe that an issue at the minute is that, you know, certainly in the movie world, brands open movies and movie stars don't. And there's precious little room for someone, say, like Billy Friedkin, who wants to make The French Connection, just wants to make a really great thriller on not so big a budget without any real understanding of how the audience is going to receive that. Taking chances, I think, is probably a little bit harder. Now, that I think that's changed a little bit with streaming. You know, if you look at someone like Chloe Zhao, Nomadland found its home on Disney Plus, ironically, through the Fox buyout. So I don't think any of this change is a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a thing. And the more you can learn to move with the tides of that, the better a position you're going to be in as a creator.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one of the things I've definitely noticed over the since the entrance of streamers and as the big franchises have come, you've got very much, you've got your big tentpole franchises that run the cinema now, and then almost all the people that would have been doing like indie filmmaking in the 90s are all in television now.
Yeah.
And I do wonder, like, and I know you've been involved in execing on smaller indie. Do you see that that's almost an impossibility to do now? Those kind of small, below 5 million indie features, and I wonder where those people are going and how they're deal making now.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, yeah, I think when TV became less of a dirty word, and you have big stars, big writers, big directors going to TV. Like, you know, the Aaron Sorkins, the David Finchers of the world, and the bigger actors, certainly the bigger actors as well, getting an understanding that, you know, you can have an exercise in long-form storytelling that can be just as creatively rewarding as a two-hour movie. It's difficult, and it's hard just to create for the hell of it these days, I think, you know, because everybody's looking for a demographic, everybody's looking for an audience. And you do get the big franchises that run the show, but I've got to say the most optimistic I've felt about any big studio is the fact that Dune is doing well and has a sequel and was made with very little interference by one of the genuinely most talented directors working in the industry today, coming off the back of a flop. You know, much as I love Blade Runner 2049, which as I know a lot of people that do, and funnily enough, I was with one of my clients today that was responsible for some of the ad placement in that film.
Right.
And showed me the design of the square bottle of Johnny Walker that Harrison Ford holds in that movie.
Right. Nice.
He's bought like 12 of these and has them in his house. But that's Denis Villeneuve, you know, who just has been allowed to take his vision and get on with it, and has delivered a movie, a remake, if you like, of the 84 version of that, that's so impenetrable, that connect the audience as well as it does, and that he's just been left to it. Now, you can have a debate around whether or not the HBO Max and cinema strategy has actually led to it earning more money than it should have been, and has maybe killed the experience, at least in Denis Villeneuve's mind. But he's just been allowed to go out there and create, and it's finding an audience. And the idea that this great science fiction book that everybody thought was unadaptable has legs and is finding its audience against Venom, against Eternals, against everything else that's out of the cinema. I actually think that's a really, really positive outlook. But then even when you look at Dune, you know, there's going to be an HBO Max series about some of the characters in that. I think people are thinking much more cross-platform than they ever have been before.
Yeah, there is really no hindrance now to doing that, because you just couldn't do that on on broadcast television that had an advertising model. It just didn't work, and the money wasn't right. The technology wasn't really there to. It would cost too much to shoot this stuff as a TV series. So, so I mean, I'm particularly interested in like your thoughts, particularly from a sort of legal perspective, on distribution strategies and where the legalities of distribution. Because again, I have students. And people ask me all the time, like, why can I watch this on Netflix in the UK but not in Norway? And I find myself that's always a good in for kind of intellectual property, but like rights management and distribution is also quite complex.
That's just the best way to start this. And I always go from the perspective of, right, I'd quite like to watch Dread again. You know,
yeah.
Surely, rather than me having to get off my ass and go find the Blu-ray, this is now on Prime. This is now on Netflix. Whatever else.
Yeah.
And what I found really interesting is Disney Plus has been a fantastic exercise in watching how you really can carve yourself out a niche. And certainly when they bought, you know, you could argue that they bought Fox just for Disney Plus because they want to broaden out appeal. And what's really interesting is when you find something that you like a TV series, something as insipid as I'm Alan Partridge, and that's been on Netflix, or that was on Netflix for as long as I can remember. And when I've got nothing else to watch, I'll watch half an hour of that. And then all of a sudden, along comes BritBox. Along comes ITV and BBC. You decide we're going to get together, we're going to corner the market. And now, because this is ours, we don't need Netflix anymore. We're going to bring it back here. And it just adds another walled garden that I think frustrates people. Because, you know, you look at the way it went with... I don't care about football, but look at, you know, Premier League matches.
Yeah.
When, you know, you had Sky Sports, Setanta at one point, BT Sport, all the rest of it. And if you wanted to watch every Premier League football game, you needed four or five different subscriptions. So I'd say the real opportunity in it is you potentially get access to a different audience every time. Like you will have, you know, people who buy into your average Netflix property and like what they get from them. I've found the experience a little bit different on Prime than it is on Netflix. Netflix thinks clearly the leader at the minute. And then you'll have a completely different experience on Disney Plus. And it'll just be a case that they've done a deal that's going to be on this platform for so long, and then it's not going to be. And the Marvel TV series are a really good example of that, in that they loaned out Punisher, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and Daredevil. But then the Marvel have taken them back now. So despite the fact they're quite critically acclaimed over there, and well, some of them were, and now you're going to see them back sort of all under the same roof. And Marvel's a really great example. You know, Marvel as a comics company went bankrupt twice, I think. And all they had to sell at one point was movie rights. So when you didn't think there was going to be such thing as superhero movies, you had Spider-Man at Sony, you had Fantastic Four and X-Men at Fox, and then all Marvel had was what they thought were the dregs of their own IP, you know, despite the fact they had 500 odd characters that didn't have Spider-Man, you know, the most merchandisable character in their library, went away and raised some money from Merrill Lynch, came up with the MCU, and then came full circle and bought Fox, so didn't have to wait for rights deals to lapse, just bought the company. And I wouldn't be surprised if they do something similar with Sony not long from now. But it's another bite at the cherry. You know, you can only assign, you can only give away your IP once. You can license it out to a willing audience as many times and in as many ways as you want to.
And I think it's those streaming wars and that are going on, and then you're having you got the big players like Disney Plus and Netflix, and then you've got the smaller players like Paramount. I mean, Paramount's not a small player, but
Peacock.
Yeah, they've kind of got this struggle to get into the marketplace because they actually haven't got the catalog. They've got a catalog of TV and so forth, but they don't necessarily have the catalog to fill. And that's the huge advantage Netflix had, was this huge catalog that they'd built up and owned the place. And I think. But I think that also possibly opens opportunities for films like Dread that maybe have kind of like hit their long, like once it got to Blu-ray, they're just waiting every 5 or 10 years to just move it to another distributor to put it out. Whereas now, I think until it eventually ends up in the bargain bin, now it will move around the streamers, and maybe you can get a better return by shipping it around like that. Yeah.
Well, definitely. And if you've, you know, Dreg's example, if you, much as Netflix doesn't tell anybody really how many people watch anything or how much money they make, what they can get off the back of those analytics is an idea of whether or not people actually want the Mega City One TV series that they've been talking about for years and years and years. And maybe that's worth as much to them, knowing that they've got an audience waiting for this, than taking a chance on doing another movie that they're not sure is going to find its audience, because actually it's more niche than they think. So yes, you know, they might sacrifice a little bit in box office receipts, but the data they'll get out the back of that, provided it's used properly and shared as it should be, can be every bit as valuable. You know, as a platform, you're looking at, if I'm HBO Max, for example, and you look at the Warner catalogue that's going on there, and they're struggling to catch up to what Marvel's been doing with the DC properties, if you can get an idea from analytics on HBO Max of what older movies are being watched by whom, when, then that's going to give you market research that you'd never get through any other means.
Yeah, because like Nielsen ratings or the various rating systems, they were like five people. It was like Gogglebox, the five people who were watching it, and the box on the top told you what they were watching, not actual data. Yeah. So one other area that I'm really, and I get asked a lot of questions about this, which is why I bring it up, is it's also when people are trying to get something off the ground. And I think like, either a company, or as in a media company, or a small production company, or even just a project, that initial deal making and how to get distribution or production funding. Do you kind of have views on that, about the process, and particularly what the legal implications are, and where a lawyer does stuff?
Well, where a lawyer does, I mean, that's kind of, it's the same as any kind of startup business. You know, if you treat it that way, if you're that desperate to get your work out there, then the worry is that you'll do a deal that will hamstring you for the rest of your life. And you might think this only has, you know, your work only has a certain shelf life. And as I say, once it's gone, it's gone. And film, obviously, copyright works very differently depending upon the medium that you're working in, whether it's film or it's sound recording or, you know, or literary or artistic works or whatever else. And film, you know, financing for movies has always been, and TV shows as well, has always been a bit of a dark art, I think. And where I think you find a lot of money being made these days on the more expensive end of things is if you've got to commit a particularly large budget to something, then you're going to make up half of that in product placement before you even get off the ground. Of course, if you're a new filmmaker or a starting director or a producer, you don't have that luxury. So as I say, it's just don't give the farm away. You know what the rights are worth and know what you can lend as opposed to give. And sometimes lending is just as powerful. Now, if you want to get one project out there to get yourself a name and then hopefully build on the back of that, then you may well be willing to give the farm away and give the keys away to some of your most valuable IP. Because ultimately, you know, you can have these great ideas that nobody ever sees, and that all they ever are great ideas. But I think there are a lot of people will make investments in movies now, in ways that you wouldn't have seen before, just because they want to say they've got the name and the credits of something. It's not necessarily just the big studios anymore. It's not just broadcasts anymore. There's plenty of ways to do it, and we're really lucky. Certainly in the UK, and I think across Europe as well, that we've got this fantastic contingent of really talented up-and-coming indie producers and directors that will be the next stars. You know, that you'll go and see do great things. And it's one of the great joys of this job, that every now and again you get to be part of that alchemy. It's a really rare privilege.
Yeah, no, great. And I think, again, people often worry about like, oh, I should go to a lawyer when something goes wrong. And I've always thought like, it actually, you should seek out a lawyer fairly early doors, because they can give you good advice, even if they're not going to deal with contracts or whatever. And people often worry like that's going to cost a lot of money, etc. Is that a true myth, or how do you think people should approach lawyers, particularly in this field, and involve them?
How do I answer this question without kind of wholly self-serving? It's tough. Look, as much as the starving artist is going to make money out of their creation, you know, lawyers have got mortgages to pay, the same as everybody else. Where we've done ourselves a disservice is assuming that we're the most important people in the room. We absolutely aren't, unless I say that. But then I remember Chris McQuarrie starting out his life as a lawyer, and wrote *Usual Suspects* when he was in a law firm. And I tell myself, one day, my son, this could be you. I mean, we're trying something a little bit different now, in that we've got a product that lets you buy legal services like you would subscribe to Netflix. You know, you buy chunks of time.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
You know, if you don't use it, then it rolls over for up to a year, and it's been met with a lot more enthusiasm than I expected to. And it was designed for the creative sector. It was designed for the agency sector, actually. But, you know,
right.
You know, lawyers, it's your worth as a lawyer isn't just the money you make. It's, I've always said, I've had a successful career if I've got my name in the credits of a movie, in the credits of a book, or on the credits of a CD. And I've got two of those.
Yeah.
And I'll be happy. I'm on the BFI website.
Yeah.
And that's the coolest thing in the world. And I did that. That's a pro bono job. And it was one of the most fulfilling things I've ever done.
Nice. And I think that is true. There are, as with any of us that work as professionals in this industry, there are these passion projects. You're like, yeah, I can do something with that. I can help that, etc. And that's about having a good, therefore, as a indie or an up and coming creator, you need to be good at networking and getting on with people, right?
Oh yeah. Oh, well, without a shadow of doubt. Yeah. I mean, you do, networking, it's sometimes a lot of this is more good luck than it is good judgment. You know, just being the right room with the right people at the right time, just when they are going to need your talent. It's really difficult to predict when that's going to happen for you. But knowing your way around your fellow filmmaking community, knowing, you know, trying to get yourself a good agent, certainly if you're a script writer or if you're a talent. Agents, I think, can be every bit as valuable as lawyers. And it's just about having a team of people around you that you know are looking out for you is one of the most important uses of your time, especially when you're just getting started.
Certainly reflecting on my starting, I was very lucky. I was at Disney. So right next to my production office, I had all the Disney in-house lawyers, and I used to go and pester them on a daily basis going, what does this mean? How does that? Because I kind of geeked out on deal law and kind of any media law. I don't know why. It was the sort of production manager in me. And it was great. I felt like for a year, I had like a mini law school in specific kind of media stuff, which I realized later that not everyone has the chance to do that.
Yeah.
I think media professionals should go to like legal networking events, you know, the same way we met through Twitter and a bunch of kind of creative people coming together with legal Twitter and hanging and having a beer together and stuff. I think you should do that and mix within the industries, not just your own.
Oh, definitely. And you know, there's a friend of mine who I've never met in person, don't think we've ever had a face-to-face conversation, is in business affairs. He's a lawyer for Warner Brothers, and he gets to, that's my dream job. You know, he gets to spend his time working with some of the greatest properties in the world. And sometimes, you know, the Wizard of Oz metaphor, knowing what's behind the curtain can make the final product that much more meaningful when you get to it.
Yeah, no, definitely. And of course, on the flip side of that, there is also the area of litigation that you can stumble into. And we see people doing that all the time. I'm wondering what, particularly in social media, I don't like the term cancel culture, but there is this area where people are kind of losing their livelihoods, and some of it is on all different scales. And I'm sure that many that involves litigation. It involves complexity. So, when things go wrong, what kind of issues do you have to deal with across the?
Well, when things go wrong on social, when do things go right on social?
yeah, that's true.
You know, it's I think social media in particular, humor doesn't travel well, and getting that balance right is very, very difficult. Normally on social, the disputes you see tend to be around, say, advertising content, but that's rarely a dispute. That's going up to the ASA to make their mind of whether or not they breach the cap code. Issues around reputation, that's going to be defamation. And the thing about that, of course, is that can spread like wildfire over the web. Yeah. And all the evidence you need on the impact that of what someone says about somebody else and the impact on their reputation is in the replies on Twitter.
Yeah.
There's been some really interesting discussion around what I remember a few years ago, GIFs, for example, legal or not a GIF is, whether or not a GIF can ever be a substantial part of a copyright work. And there was a Twitter account that was testing this out by showing Top Gun in GIF form over a series of tweets.
Right.
Pushing fair use as far as I go. But again, that's a territorial thing. You know, copyrights, it's treated a little bit differently in different jurisdictions. So it's hard to say, you know, where disputes start and end, but certainly whenever you've got to the state, I mean, there is always, if you ever end up in litigation over any kind of creative issue, you've always got to write and set your case out to the other side before you run off to court. And there are very, very different systems in the US, in the UK. If you're looking at a copyright infringement case, for example, it's normally going to be damages by way of what you would have paid had you bought a license to use the content that you're using, or an account of profits and costs on top of that. Whereas in the States, you get punitive damages. So it's not just what the license fee would have been. And we saw this in the illegal downloading cases years ago, one with a lady who had to pay out millions for downloading 15 Def Leppard songs.
Yeah.
You know, you'd never get that. You'd never get that in the UK. But interestingly, you know, what we still export in the UK is creativity. And it's respected, it is treated very well, but very few people would walk into a dispute over creativity hoping to earn money out of it. It more often than not, it's point of principle.
Right. Yeah. In the agency world, what kind of issues do you deal with there, particularly on maybe some of the deals or brand management, etc.? What issues do you have in the agency sector? Because there are all these different sectors and they all cross over, I guess.
Yeah, agencies, more often than not, it's we built something and the project's gone wrong. Or we've been involved in the campaign and we thought we'd cleared something. It turns out we haven't. We've used a song and we didn't get the usage rights in the way that we thought we would do.
Yeah.
That more often than not. If it's something gone wrong during a project, then it's more often than not, it's a contractual issue. But then, say, you might bring as an agency some background IP to a project, something that you develop that you want to use for everybody. And then a client will come to you and say, well, I'm paying you, I want to own your soul, and because I'm paying you for it. And that can get really difficult to separate out what you want to keep and use for other people and what you're willing just to give to the client. Or do you say, do I give it to the client or do I just let them use it for as long as they need to for whatever they need to use it for, but I retain the rights? And more often than not, what we do see an awful lot of actually are agency clients we work with signing up to NDAs. And the NDA will say, okay, we will talk to each other. We'll give you information. You'll give us information. So it's mutual. Oh, but by the way, anything we talk about will end up owned by us. The IP in that will end up owned by us. The confidential information, as far as that goes, will end up owned by us. And then you realize from pitch stage in particular, you might just have signed away the secret sauce that would have got you into a relationship that could have helped your business stay sustainable for a good few years. That's really tough.
Yeah.
You know, being on it, I think certainly starting out on any kind of project, the early stages, thinking about discovery, thinking about your actual scope of work and thinking about what you're willing to give away and when, is more often than not where these battles are fought and won.
Yeah, because I can remember that age-old thing, like when I was a student, they used to teach us, put your idea or your paperwork in an envelope and send it to yourself, and that'll all be okay.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's a bit more complicated still than happens. That. Yeah.
Seriously, it still happens. Yeah. Still get people saying, right, I've sent this to you now. I know you don't know me very well, but here it is. Okay, so then I've got to keep this in a safe now. We now have,
really?
Yeah, we have this relationship now where I've got to hold on to this until kingdom come. Not very often these days. I mean, again, when you've got digital tech and digital timestamps and metadata, that's maybe changed a lot of that. But I think there are still old wives' tales out there.
Yeah, yeah. And particularly, I suppose, in the agency and the PR side, and I'm interested from the creator side, because I know, like, there are lots of freelance photographers out there who are doing stuff for clients. And one of the biggest moans I hear from photographers is how clients don't understand the services they're buying. And I'm wondering, like, have you seen both sides of that particularly?
Yes.
Like, what are you buying when you buy a photograph?
Photographs under UK copyright law are treated very differently in that they are singled out for a special kind of treatment. And as a result of that, photographers have slightly more control over how they're used and are occasionally 100% more militant about how they're used. Now, a lot of them will go to an image bank like Corbis or King or Rexall, something like that, and hand it over to them and let them do all the rights management for them. some of them will be independent and want to do it themselves, and just look out for when people are using their imagery without a proper license in place. But yeah, photographs are a special case in their own right, and quite rightly defended very jealously by those who take the image.
I suppose, like, we're increasingly getting the image banks and the video banks globally now, where you can go and buy rights. Do you think it's smart sometimes, like, I have students here who can go out and shoot beautiful scenery and so forth, and obviously sell that footage to people if it's the right format. Is it better for them to almost, when you're starting out, put it in some of those libraries and let the rights management be dealt with through that, rather than trying to negotiate it individually yourself and dealing with individual contracts?
Well, I'd say so. If for nothing else, you've then got at least some income coming in. And you don't have to give everything away. And the more you get used to thinking about how your rights are protected and what the terms of these deals with the platforms are, the more the issues will start to come to life for you. And the more you'll get an idea of, not that it's the be all and end all, the kind of content that's going to be worth more, and a better idea of what that's worth as well. And where, you know, how much a worldwide license would be over a particular territory for a particular set of usage in a particular campaign. And, you know, maybe dipping your toe in either pond is probably a good idea, but certainly a bank of content that you can go away and at least earn even a small amount of money on to start you getting some income out of it. Absolutely. You're going to give a lot of it away, because they will say, we've built the house that enables you to get that money back in. But, you know, at least
exactly. And I think if you're not too worried, particularly when you're starting out, to be raking in, but you won't rake it in anyway. It's almost a good testing, sort of like a bike with stabilizers that you can go through rights management without getting into a nightmare of suddenly having to interpret your own deal memos and so forth. You mentioned NDAs, and I just wanted to say for the uninitiated, that means non-disclosure agreement. Do you want to just explain, because non-disclosure agreements are very commonplace now, almost for anybody entering into a discussion, and they've been used in hostile ways and they've been used in very positive ways. Do you want to just talk a little bit about what, so that people understand what they are?
No, absolutely. So if the whole point of a non-disclosure agreement is that you are acknowledging the confidentiality of the information that you hand over to somebody else. Under English law, if information is worth something, if it has what's called the quality of confidence, it's not public domain, it's something that you've developed on your own, and it's disclosed in a way that suggests an obligation of confidence, then you can protect it as confidential information. Potentially, you can junk someone to stop using it. And the reason you have an NDA, for one, is to kind of set a backdrop and a common vocabulary to be able to say, right, these are the truths we hold self-evident. This is what confidential information is worth to us. These are the circumstances, in particular, the purpose for which I'm making that disclosure. And if I give you that information, if you use it for any other use and for any other reason other than the purpose, then I'm going to take action against you. And more often than not, if it is an equal footing where you're sharing information with somebody else and they're doing the same with you, it'll be what they call a mutual agreement. So protected disclosure made by each party. More often than not, sometimes even if you send an NDA and then tell the person that you're talking to what you intended to tell them, that can be enough to set the scene to help you if you then have a problem after the fact, if you need to prove that information is confidential. But more often than not, they're just there to set the scene so you can have an open conversation, because once confidential information is no longer confidential, you can never, ever put the genie back in the bottle. And it's all about having setting the scene. Yeah, is the best way I can describe it. It teaches you what is in a contract and the value of a contract as well, I think, because confidential information isn't IP. You know, it's a different kind of right. And once it's gone, it's gone. So you need to treat it like the very fragile commodity that it is. Now, NDAs get a bad name when they are used as part of a settlement agreement, for example. So what's changed the approach to NDAs, certainly in the UK, are things like the Weinstein litigation, where NDAs were being used by lawyers to silence people from speaking their truth, for example. And that's changed now. And when we deal with NDAs or when we deal with settlements, we'll make it clear that, you know, there is nothing here that's stopping you going to a regulator to blow the whistle on something. So it, confidential information, I mean, IP rights and certainly copyright doesn't protect an idea. It protects the expression of that idea.
Yeah.
The idea is protected as confidential information, and that is protected through an NDA.
Right. Okay, cool, cool, cool. And I think it's increasingly people freak out when they first hear, like, oh, you've got to sign an NDA. And I think the first one I had to do was actually when Kubrick was making Eyes Wide Shut. And he was literally just scoping around in the place that I was working. And I was like, what's this? I felt like I was signing the Official Secrets Act at the time. It was kind of like...
Kubrick.
And now... it becomes increasingly hard to have interviews with filmmakers because they're like, oh, that's still under an NDA. I can't talk about that project. What do you see, I suppose, sort of looking forward, what do you see as the kind of future of how the media is going to evolve? And particularly when we hear like Zuckerberg talking about metaverse and stuff, and can you see a whole new landscape of law there and business?
So Zuck's an interesting topic of conversation. In the UK, we are looking to be the first country in the world, and not so much creativity, but we are going to regulate social media, or more accurately, we're going to try through the online safety bill. And we're going to do that because the UK wants to be the safest place in the world to be online, and because they're concerned about trolling, they're concerned about revenge porn. And increasingly, the impacts of social media means that unless you've got an awful lot of money and say someone is trolling you online and you want to find out who it is, you probably need to get a court order to disclose that information in California or wherever they're based. And because social media crosses all borders, it's really hard to try and apply one system of regulation to it. But what the UK is going to do is say, if you've got an audience over here, what you're going to have to do as a platform is to carry out risk assessment and put processes and procedures in place to protect your users from harm. You're going to have a brand new duty of care to protect your users from harm. Now, we've had privacy data protection regulation in the UK for years, run by the ICO. And really what's fascinating is the regulator they've chosen to oversee online harms is Ofcom on the basis... it's their experience in broadcast. You know, they make decisions regarding content, and it's not about taking content down. It's having these processes and systems and procedures in place to deter harm. I think that is going to be absolutely fascinating. And where you're a Zuckerberg, and for years and years and years, all you worried about was making a platform that was suitable for advertisers and was a good place to go and get metrics from. Now, all of a sudden, you found that it's being used for really great reasons and really terrible reasons, depending upon your view of its impact upon democracy, depending upon your view on its impact in everyday life. What I think is really interesting from a social media platform's point of view is that they've almost tried, Facebook Watch being a really good example of this, they've tried getting into this content space. And I think they kind of recognize that maybe it's not for them. YouTube a little bit differently, but YouTube really struggled with this when it first started because they had all kinds of lawsuits brought by people like Viacom when they first got going, because you would have their properties stuck on YouTube by people. And it wasn't anticipated that would be the case. I think with the opportunity is endless now, potentially. But I do worry, and as we were hinting at before, you know, whether the cinema experience in particular is going to change, whether it's only going to be the really high-end, big-budget stuff that you see in cinemas, unless you've got an independent cinema near you, and there aren't that many of them. You know, if you're going to see directors that would want to tell their story online on cinema, increasingly seeing streaming as the only option. But all of a sudden, you know, more options and more avenues and more routes for creativity to be made available to a wider world, I don't see as any kind of bad thing.
No. I mean, it's interesting, like the cycle of innovation and so forth, because I think with the Facebooks, the YouTubes, etc., we're seeing actually we're in the phase now of the solidification of that. Like, you've gone through the innovation and you've had the Wild West, you know, piracy built YouTube, and then eventually eventually you got tightening and tightening. You had Adpocalypse, which was basically just having the same kind of regulation put upon you as any broadcaster would have about adverts that you put out. And I think, so does that, do they become the incumbents and they therefore they become the Murdoch empire or the IBMs of their era? And does, and I think that's what's interesting about them saying the metaverse, like they're going to own it or they're going to create it. Does the, whatever the metaverse is, become the new decentralized Wild West whilst that solidifies? And then we're into it. It just feels like we always get to the point where we regulate and that's really important for all the right reasons, but then it instantly then creates somebody trying to circumvent it in a new way.
We regulate the web, we can't regulate the dark web. No. Because we can't get access to it. And yeah, as they, I think we forget at our peril the idea that social media has only really been a thing for about 15 years, maybe 20. And all of a sudden, you, as we were talking about before, you want to get your work out to the wider world. You don't need to be a broadcaster. You don't need to get a commission. You don't need to have airtime. You can just put your stuff out there. The downside of that, of course, is that if you think about it from a journalism perspective, you are, you don't have, say, media law training, and you don't realize the risk inherent with posting what you're about to post. And thinking back to legal philosophy 25 years ago, the idea, the marketplace of ideas that everybody gets to have their say and then objective truth comes out of that, I think that's kind of where we are. I think audiences and social media users are still getting to grips with the impact that this these platforms are having on our everyday lives. Maybe looking past that, saying, you know, we're going to look at the meta thing. You know, as an exercise in rebranding, everybody's still going to say Facebook, and the timing of it when they're under particular legislative pressure, and you've got Frances Haugen as the whistleblower testifying both in the UK and the US about what they did or didn't know about safety on their platform. You know, it's a different logo, but they're going to have to grow up in public, because increasingly you're going to see governments wanting to have more of a say in tech that now has found its way irrevocably into our everyday life.
It's interesting. I was having a discussion with somebody the other day, what we call tech. And I was like, when do we stop calling it tech? Like, when did we stop calling the wheel tech? Like, and when did we stop calling the phone tech? You know, and I think the rate of change in technology is so rapid, our brains cannot actually keep up with. So we're like, literally monkeys in 2001 kind of finding that
there's that Kubrick.
We haven't quite evolved to really cope with the complexity of what these things open up about our innate humanity. And it's scary, because what we've got people kind of pushing to see how far they can push something to almost get as far away from humanity as they, you know, with, I always see AI as far away from humanity as you can get.
But then, you know, you get back to the, if you're utopian, you go back to that Arthur C. Clarke quote that I can never remember properly about technology being indistinguishable from magic. And you look at, you know, where it wasn't Cortana, there was an AI bot, I think it was one of Microsoft's, that you fed information into it, and pretty quickly it decided that it hated everyone and was hurling racist insults. But we've been living with, you know, the UK, I was looking at some figures the other day, I think is the best adopter of IoT, home assistant tech, pretty much in the world. And maybe we're a bit more used to it. We don't recognize AI and the presence it already has in our lives. You know, Siri, Alexa, I'm saying this, and three different devices in this one room are about to have a, you know, a senior moment. But it's here. You know, it's not Skynet.
I don't know that one.
That cue was brilliant, Steve.
There it is. Doing it again. But you know, we're not. It's not Skynet, and you know, we're looking at the regulation of AI and how much of that power we're looking to devolve away from our own thought process. But I look around and it's here now, and it's been almost a drip into everybody's lives that they don't appreciate how much of their day is enabled by tech of any number of different kinds, whether it's AI the wheel or anything else.
No, I think it's Gibson. The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed.
If that's the Gibson, I think it is. Apparently, he wrote a really good script for Alien 3.
Which I've read. It's very good.
Right. Okay. Well, I know what's in my Amazon cart after we finish this discussion.
Have you not seen the comic book of his script?
I have seen it. I haven't read it yet.
It's so good. Do take a moment.
But Alien 3 is the kind of the story, isn't it? Finch's first Hollywood movie, and nearly working on an established property as a commercials director that walked into the big feature film, and Fox very nearly broke it.
Yeah.
And yet he's gone on to become this fantastic auteur, you know, presence of his own. As much as you might say he's like, you know, one of these visual directors, very, very much like a Ridley Scott or maybe even a Michael Bay, if you want to insult him. But, you know, that's kind of, if anybody wanted to dig into a making of about an artist walking into commerce, all the stuff around what Fincher went through and Alien 3 is a great place to start.
And there's a wonderful book by Art Linson, the producer, where there's a chapter about the making of Fight Club. And I think because of the experiences Fincher had had with Fox, he had it very specifically written in his deal to have final cut on that film, and he could just do what he wanted.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a brilliant bit in that chapter that explains the screening room with all the Fox executives. And apparently one of them actually threw up because they realized their job was like, and apparently Fincher just sat there laughing because he knew what he'd done. So I always like that story of, like, not only did he go on to do stuff, but he kind of paid it back a bit as well.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. I'm conscious that our hour is up, and I'm conscious of billable hours, Steve. So
for the avoidance of doubt, the clock is not running.
Cool. And it's lovely to catch up with you. And I'm trying to angle getting over to come and see the Salford Media School. So we'll try and get a beer. It'd be lovely to catch up with you again.
That'd be amazing, John. It's really great to see you after so long. And we have great conversations on Facebook, and this has been another one. And just really grateful for you spending a bit of time with me on a Thursday night.
Yeah, it was lovely. Lovely talking to you, mate. Cheers ever so much. Take care.
Yeah, man. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bet on myself and I proved it. I know the industry ruthless. I'm really a threat, a nuisance. The Chevy you're driving is ruthless. Think I'm the one and I proved it. I know the industry foolish. Think we're seeing the movies. It really ain't driving, I'm cooling. Look at me struggling right